Did you ever wonder what it would be like to be part of the SparkFile coaching community? Here's how the SparkFile community describes it.
The most honest, safe, life-affirming, and life-changing experience I've had in all my 55 years. The best.
I'm incredibly grateful to Laura and Susan for teaching me the tools and structures that I need to get past the fear and to just do it anyway.
The SparkFile is a portal to your creative powers and believing in yourself.
This group is spiritually, emotionally, mentally
supportive, creative,
amazing, encouraging,
life-shifting, and liberating.
Uber talented, warm, thoughtful, lovely, wonderful people.
I need a group like this to give me the kick in the ass that I need to start making the things that I want to make and do.
This big, beautiful, creative trampoline that just like catches you gently and just launches you out with so much love.
If you want to learn more about the SparkFile Creativity Coaching, including our 6-month Blaze course, visit thesparkfile.com/blaze and schedule a no pressure, no obligation call to find out what is possible and how we can support you. It's time to take it and make it.
The SparkFile podcast may contain profanity and other adult content. Please use your discretion.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my SparkFile.
SparkFile.
To be something that I want to make or how I want to be. Pump it in my SparkFile.
SparkFile.
I jump into my SparkFile.
SparkFile.
Let's open up the SparkFile.
Welcome to the SparkFile, your one-stop maker lab for creative inspiration.
I'm Laura Camion.
And I'm Susan Blackwell. If you're joining us for the first time, oh, you are so welcome. If
yes.
You're joining us for the 1,000,000th time,
we're so snuggled up with you.
You may be asking yourself, what exactly is a Spark File? Where do I get one? What do I file in it? These are such good questions, and we do have answers.
Mm-hmm. A Spark File is a place where you consistently collect all of your inspirations and fascinations.
But here's the deal. We are makers, and we make all kinds of things.
If you're like us, and you're making stuff all the time, or want to be making stuff all the time, you know that the wellspring of inspiration can run a little dry.
So we're on the lookout for fresh ideas, images, and inspiration that spark our creativity and pique our curiosity, things that inspire us to get up off of our asses and make things like this podcast.
Or a fewer, better mindset to clear some physical and mental space.
Interesting.
Mm.
Or a brilliant mind hidden behind dazzling beauty.
Ooh. Every episode, we're going to reach into our spark files and exchange some sparks. And from time to time, we're going to talk to some folks who spark us too.
And if you're not careful, you might just see past the surface. So without further ado, let's open up
The Spark File.
Camion
Blackwell.
Welcome.
Oh, thanks. Welcome to you.
I just realized in that little teaser that, you know how we tease each other with like, what's our spark going to be?
Yeah.
I was like, that's not really something you make, a brilliant mind. I was like,
mine is also not something you make. So scrap this episode. It's done.
We're both fired. We're rehired. We renegotiate our contracts. Is there anything that you want to say to the people before we jump in?
I'm just excited. I'm excited to share some sparks and exchange some ideas. And, you know, the more we do this, the more we get notes from people who have made things. And I just can't tell you how thrilling it is.
It is the best.
It makes my entire day. Someone will just send us something on Instagram or email and be like, hey, I was listening to this and I made this, and it knocks our socks off.
Or I was listening to this, it reminded me
of
I wanted to share this, and then it sparks me.
Yeah.
Or it sparks you.
Yeah. It's so awesome.
That is a joy.
Yeah. It feels really good.
Circle
so
of sparks.
So I'm just like floating on air over here.
I love that. Should we dive in?
Yeah.
Okay. My spark title for the day.
Okay.
She was not only thinking outside the box, she didn't even know that a box existed.
Oh, I like her already.
Get ready. My spark sources include a documentary called Bombshell by a filmmaker named Alexandra Dean, an episode of The Kamala Show on YouTube, and good old, sometimes reliable Wikipedia.
Hey! Yay! Thanks, Wiki.
So this spark is the story of Hedwig Eva Maria Kiesler. Hedwig was born on November 9th, 1914 in Vienna. She was an only child. Both her parents were born into Jewish families. Her parents were wealthy and cultured, and they took young Hedwig to the theater and the opera, and they lived in Vienna in a very fashionable, artistic district. Travel with me through time and space. Have you been to Vienna?
No.
Wait, I haven't. I want to go. It sounds so beautiful.
No.
Let's go.
Yeah. Can we?
On the world tour.
Yes.
Of the Spark File podcast.
Yes, please.
Okay. So little Hedwig had a very curious mind. Her father, Emil, was a successful bank director, but he was also interested in technology. So when they went for their walks together, he would point out how things worked, like electricity and streetcars and factories. And she learned to associate invention with her father, whom she adored. So I watched this interview with documentarian Alexandra Dean. What a basket of sparks she is. I watched this interview with her on an episode of Kamala Show. And this is a program that covers women in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, STEM.
Okay.
Alexandra said that studying inventors over the last 10 to 15 years, as she has, how frequently you find a parent behind that inventor who really enjoyed and loved their child's intellect.
Yes.
And that parent is frequently a father, and that is the case with little Hedwig, which I thought was such an interesting distinction that she made.
Yeah, that they get such delight out of seeing how their child's brain works, because you can, it's so malleable, and you can truly see the eureka moments in a child.
And
they're not hiding them.
Yeah. To maybe what they become.
That's awesome.
So Hedwig's father encouraged her to take things apart and put them back together again. And at the age of five, she took her music box apart and put it back together. She was very bold about asking how things worked. She had a very inventive mind and a sort of a fearlessness about discovering the world, which I loved. I possessed none of those things as a child, but hats off to you, Hedwig. She attended private school in Vienna, and her favorite class was chemistry. In a different era, she might have become a scientist, but it was an option that was derailed by her beauty.
Whoa.
At the age of 12, Hedwig won a beauty contest in Vienna. By the time she was a teen, she was so beautiful that they say when she walked into a room, conversations would stop.
Oh my God.
Can you imagine? I can only imagine.
Is this my life story?
As someone who did not look like that as a young person, I can only imagine.
What is that like?
But Hedwig described her younger self as an enfant terrible, like just like one of those, you know, like just,
yes.
She sounds like she was probably
like a terrible infant.
Beautiful little handful.
Yeah.
When she was 16, not short on confidence, when she was 16, she walked into the largest movie studio in Vienna, and in short order, they started to put her in films. And one of her earliest was the film Ecstasy, where she appeared nude. And she also,
at 16?
Simulated kind of like an orgasm on camera.
At 16.
Yeah.
Where are the child labor laws?
Well,
sorry.
Not in Vienna, apparently. Hello. So the Pope denounced the film. Hitler declared it should not be shown.
It
made some waves, and some larger than life figures were not happy about this film. It was sort of like having a sex tape.
Yeah.
And her father, her beloved father, was outraged. Yeah, with a minor.
With a minor. Sort of like child pornography. Right. I don't want to take us to a dark place, but it sounds like she made a bold move.
Yes.
A bold choice.
It was she makes clear that the simulated orgasm, like she's fully clothed and there was nobody else in the room with her the way
they shot it.
You just see her.
A coming of age moment.
Her face.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So coming of age, I guess. After that, she got married to a munitions tycoon named Fritz Mandl. Fritz was a super interesting guy. He was one of the most powerful munitions suppliers to the Nazis. He also worked with Mussolini. He was this very powerful figure on the Axis side, but he was Jewish, so Hitler wouldn't even be in the same room with him.
This story has some layers already. Listen, that I'm like, what?
You have to buckle your seatbelt, because this story is like a spark layer cake. It's crazy. And you could take any one of these little anecdotes or little characters like Fritz Mandl and completely like, just there's like, your screenplay.
What were you, what, I mean, yeah.
It's
what
was so he doing? Interesting. So,
okay. But are we to believe from this, and maybe you'll clarify later, but are we to believe that she and her husband were supportive of
the Nazis? I'm gonna present something to you right now.
Okay.
The Allies in World War II would eventually nickname Fritz Mandl the Merchant of Death. But according to documentarian Alexandra Dean, the deeper that you dig, the more sympathetic he becomes. Now, I don't want to take away from the fact that he was like one of the biggest munitions suppliers to the Axis forces. But it turns out that the Nazis actually took his Jewish father, Fritz Mandl's Jewish father. They put him in a concentration camp in order to coerce Fritz Mandl to take their money, take it to Argentina, and become something of a banker for the Nazis, but in order to preserve his own family, which he did. So he ended up
to keep his dad
saving
alive.
His family by doing evil things.
By killing millions of
people. Yes. It's not black
and white.
It's
not so clean. Yep.
Nothing ever is. Yeah. So back to Hedwig. So with Fritz, Hedwig and Fritz had this country, in addition to their other, I'm sure, real estate, they had this country house with 25 guest rooms. And she really loved it for a time. Yeah, picture it. She really loved it for a time, but then it became her job to sit and be beautiful, and she was bored out of her mind. But because Hedwig was married to this guy and sitting at these dinner tables with his Nazi munitions clients, she was privy to early discussions about what the racial laws would be, what would constitute Jewish, who would be sent to concentration camps. And there she is, somebody who is of Jewish descent, this beautiful woman, beautifully dressed, sitting at these dining tables. I mean, whoa, what a position to be in.
And she's, I presume, soaking it all up.
She's also got magnificent brain.
That's right.
So if all of that wasn't shitty enough, her husband became jealous and paranoid about his beautiful wife. He started buying up prints of the film Ecstasy, in which she had appeared nude.
Of course.
And the more he bought up, the more they would print because they could make as many copies as he would buy. He had the maids listening in on Hedwig's phone calls. It was the classic story of she had everything she could ever want except for her freedom. And
she was basically in a cage.
Yeah, a beautiful bird in a cage. So by 1937, the war was inevitable and Hedwig was in this really tense situation. Jewish people's civil rights were being stripped away and the stress of that climate brought on her beloved father's sudden death by heart attack. And this was a real turning point for her. So
I'm sorry. He saved his own father. I keep going back to that. I'm like, okay, so he saved his own father, but
not Hedwig's.
Okay.
So after several failed attempts to escape from her husband and from this life, one night they were having a dinner party and Hedwig, as the woman of the house, helped choose the maids and the caretakers for the house. She found a maid who looked a lot like her. She made two cups of tea, one of them with a sleeping powder. She switched cups with the maid. The maid drank it and fell asleep. Hedwig had sewn her jewels into the lining of her coat. She put on the maid's costumes. She jumped on her bike and she successfully escaped.
Oh my gosh. By bicycle.
Dressed as a maid. After several failed attempts, she would escape and they would like bring her back. This life is an amazing life.
This is incredible.
We haven't even scratched the surface. So her parents had friends in England. So she escaped to England and she spent several months in pre-war London, which was something of a safe haven. And while she was there, she saw a Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer movie that had the lion at the beginning that goes,
MGM.
And she said, I want that. And she ended up meeting MGM studio head Louis B. Mayer, who had come to Europe to buy up all the actors and actresses who were escaping from Nazi Germany, which that in and of itself is a fascinating moment. because he figured he could get them for a cheap price. Mm-hmm. He offered Hedvig $125 per week. She said, that's not good enough. And she walked out of the meeting. Then she immediately booked passage, because she's so smart. She immediately booked passage on the ship that Mare was sailing back to New York. And on that trip, she made sure that she was out on the deck in her tennis clothes and her bathing suit. And then on the first or second night, she went to her little modest cabin and she put on one of her designer gowns that she had escaped with. And she walked past Louis B. Mare's table. And Douglas Fairbanks was sitting at Mare's table. And apparently his eyes were glued to her. Louis B. Mare circled back and offered her $500 a week for her to be on an MGM contract. But they all knew that the name Hedvig Kiesler had to change. And on that boat out at sea, Louis B. Mayer's wife came up with Hedvig's new name. And though Hedvig only had a few sentences of English, when she stepped off the ship, she was met with photographers and reporters who wanted to meet Louis B. Mayer's latest discovery, Hedy Lamarr.
Hedy Lamarr.
Are you familiar with Hedy Lamarr?
I am a little bit. Like, as you were talking, I was like, I think this might be Hedy Lamarr.
Hedy Lamarr.
But you've already given me so many details, I had no idea.
Oh, my gosh. This documentary that Alexandra Dean made, Bombshell, I was going to say this 17 times, it's so good. It's such a good documentary. But I just want to get in your mind's eye, and we'll share this on social media. This is what Hedy Lamarr looks like.
Exquisite. Exquisitely beautiful.
I feel like she looks a bit like Vivien Leigh.
She does.
Like
she's more than a bit. Beautiful, yeah.
She's a white lady. She's a brunette. She's got, you know, that beautiful symmetrical face. Here's some more pictures of her.
Mm-hmm.
Hair parted down the middle and then cascading into curls.
Yep.
She's gorgeous.
Yes.
She was a stunner.
But you just also mentioned she didn't speak much English.
She didn't, but she got that good brain. So she, you know.
She learned it.
She learned.
Quick.
She learned it to be in movies. Yeah. So she gets to Hollywood. Charles Boyer saw her at a party and was just smitten by her. And he asked that she be in his movie Algiers, which put her on the map. And suddenly she was on the cover of all these movie magazines. And a lot of famous starlets started styling themselves to look like her.
That's why
when you look at her, you're like, oh, Vivien Leigh looks like her. And, you know,
but everyone was trying to look like her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She also became friends with like the biggies, Charlie Chaplin, Orson Welles, Howard Hughes, John Kennedy asked her out. At this point, she is so desired. She could have married anyone, but she surprised everyone by choosing a screenwriter named Gene Markey. And it seemed like she was deeply in love with him. They even adopted a son.
Just a little thread that I want to tie up.
Yeah.
So what about did she get divorced from the other guy? She just
away. I think she must have. I think at some point she must have, because what we're going to learn is that she married several people. She had several marriages. So I'm assuming there was marriage divorce.
Wow.
I also had that question.
So interesting. Just because I'm also still wondering, like, what happened after she escaped? Did he come looking for her? You know, she got out, which is amazing.
She got out.
I'm so curious.
And escaped that war on Europe's soil.
Yeah.
So back to Gene Markey.
Yes.
Oh, wait, did you have another thing you
just
were saying?
So I was just going to say, so she chose a screenwriter.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So she chose the screenwriter. Deeply in love with him, they even adopted a son, but within months of their marriage, he began dating other actresses.
What the hell?
I know. It's so funny because when you look at a picture of Gene Markey, you're like, he must have had one hell of a personality.
Yeah. And I was going to say, and real balls. Like, what the hell?
He must have been amazing in
the
sack.
He has the most glorious and intelligent.
He liked the ladies. So he began dating other actresses. She was heartbroken. And she said, people never got past her face. You never knew if they loved you or their fantasy of you, which I think is interesting and creates the tension that I feel like was present for Hedy Lamarr's whole life.
Yeah.
This tension between her brain and her beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, back to Hetty.
Yeah.
So her career's taking off. And in the 40s, they ran these actors and actresses who were on contract. They ran them like racehorses.
Yep.
And she was given some sort of pills to wake her up to perform. And she was given pills to sleep, like very Judy Garland. They worked 6 days a week. Women had to report super early to get into that full hair, full makeup, those costumes. But after a day on the set, Hetty didn't go to sleep. She was at home working on whatever her latest invention was. Inventing was her hobby. She said she didn't have to work on ideas. They came to her naturally. She had a complete inventing table set up in her house. And Howard Hughes gave her a smaller version of the inventing equipment that she kept in her trailer that she worked with between takes. So this is how Hetty Lamarr was spending her free time. She said she had a cerebral connection with Howard Hughes. She actually said she dated him and he was a terrible lover, but they did have this cerebral connection.
Yeah.
Howard Hughes was, among other things, he's a spark, another spark another day.
He is. He's a multitude of them.
He was an airplane designer and he wanted to build the fastest planes in the world so he could sell them to the Air Force. Hetty looked at the design of his planes and those plans and thought, the end of the wings shouldn't be square. It was the time when the wings were sort of like rectilinear. They were more square.
Yeah.
She bought a book on fish. She bought a book on birds. She studied the fastest fish and the fastest bird, drew the shape of their wings / fins together, showed it to Howard Hughes, and a more modern wing shape was born.
Wow.
Hetty Lamarr. She got those brains.
She does.
It was an intense time to be Hetty Lamarr. When she started at MGM, Louis B. Mayer adamantly instructed his talent not to discuss their religious backgrounds. So Hetty never mentioned she was Jewish and would even deny it when her children would come to her and say, Mom's on the playground, somebody's, are we Jewish? She would be like, absolutely not. Or she would totally deny it and compartmentalize it. Which it seems like she had a real talent for doing.
Well, seems like she had to.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Hitler is taking over much of Western Europe and the life that she left behind is basically being wiped out. During this time, her mother had escaped Austria and made it to London, but Hetty was very anxious that her mother try to get to America. But at that time, German U-boats were torpedoing these ships that were sailing to America and killing men, women, and children.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very, very dangerous journey.
Yeah.
At that time, German U-boats were on the verge of winning the war, and they seemed to be unsinkable because they could easily outmaneuver outdated British torpedoes.
Yep.
You know so much more about the history of World War II than I know. Than I do.
Okay.
So a lot of the stuff I was like,
no, I mean, the U-boats are, it truly was a turning point. And we could have lost the war there.
Based on that technology.
That's right. Yeah.
So Hetty Lamarr, losing sleep, listening to the radio, extremely worried about the war and her mother's safety. But to quote the film Bombshell, which all of this is from, most of this is from, which you should totally watch
I'm
too,
going because to already.
It is unbelievable. But Hetty being Hetty said, I'm going to do something about that.
Oh my gosh.
I'm not just going to sit and stew. I'm going to do something about this, which gives me chills.
Yeah, I got this.
In the documentary, she says, I got the idea for my invention when I tried to think of some way to even the balance for the British. A radio-controlled torpedo, I thought, would do it.
Oh, God.
So, I know.
Just a simple, you know, radio-controlled torpedo.
I'm really sparked by this idea of thinking, instead of just being, we live in such heightened times, and instead of just being, like, completely tortured by the idea of climate change, or, like, she really was like, what can I do about it?
That's right. And she didn't stop with
change?
Like, well, someone smarter somewhere is figuring that out.
What would turn the tide of an entire world war?
That's right.
Filmmaker Alexandra Dean on The Kamala Show said, unless you're a student of World War II, which you are, Cams, but I am not, you might not know that it was a war that was fought over the radio waves. And like today, they were trying to come up with radio waves that were secure, that couldn't be hacked.
Mm-hmm.
And they were also trying to hack into the enemy's radio waves to jam them, to fill them with so much static that communication and things like the guidance of a torpedo's course could be impacted. So like today, secure communication was an obsession, and the side that could master secure communication would win the war. Mm-hmm. So here's some more science for you. This is from Bombshell. A torpedo launched at any given trajectory might need to be changed or redirected. You want, ideally, your launching boat to communicate with the torpedo. The problem at that time was that radio communication was not secure. Your enemy could find the frequency that you're communicating with your torpedo and jam it. But Hedy Lamarr co-created a way of guiding the torpedo to the target that couldn't be interrupted. It couldn't be jammed. Instead of one transmitted frequency, she asked, what if we changed those frequencies constantly in sync with each other? It was called frequency hopping. You couldn't jam it because you'd only jam a split second of it. Her concept, secure radio communications, was brilliant, but she didn't do it alone. The invention was hers, but the implementation of it was provided by a man named George Antiel. Now, before I go on, any questions about the technology? Does that make sense?
It makes total sense to me. I did not know the specificity of that. That's incredible.
The thing I love about the documentary Bombshell is Alexander Dean has done a beautiful job. I am not the most history-minded person or the most science-minded person, but the way that they literally illustrate her ideas coming to life, it is the way they animate her ideas coming to life. It made it easier for me to wrap my little brain
that's around her big brain.
around her big brain. Yes. So Alexander Dean, like,
wow.
Yeah. That's, it's really cool.
I can't wait to watch this.
Yeah. So Hedy had met George Antiel at a party. In their first conversation, apparently they were discussing how they both had these inventor's minds. They were discussing how Hedy might be able to increase her bust size. Louis B. Mayer wanted her to have a fuller figure. And George Antiel speculated, if you could influence a person's endocrine system, you could change their bust size. So she's talking about her breasts and she's like lifting up her shirt. And he was like, "Auga!" So when Hedy left the party, she wrote her phone number in lipstick on his windshield. And that was their meet cute. And it really captures those different sides of Hedy, her unbelievable intellect, her movie stardom, her boobies, like all of it.
And her chutzpah, like her writing her you know, number on his car, on his windshield. Yeah. I mean, that seriously, you
to
couldn't
me,
write that more.
That anecdote captures her perfectly. So whoever's going to write this screenplay,
there you go.
Put that in there.
There you go.
Hedy and George had a lot in common. They both left school young. Neither had advanced degrees. I want to underscore that because you don't have to have an engineering degree to have brilliant ideas. But they were both motivated. Mm-hmm. Hedy, again, was concerned about her mother's safe passage to the U.S.
That's right.
And George's brother, Henry, was one of the first Americans killed in World War II. And he was devastated and he wanted revenge for his brother's death.
Wow.
So they both had these extremely visceral motivations for wanting to make a difference. George Antiel was a wildly, this is a whole spark.
Yeah.
He's a whole spark.
Yeah.
He was a wildly interesting dude. He was an avant-garde American composer. His music is described in the documentary as jazz put into a Cuisinart. Not my favorite, but hats off to you, George Antiel. His most famous composition was called Ballet Mécanique, which he scored for, and this is a spark for you, Cams, 16 player pianos.
What?
Here's a fun fact about our friend Laura Camion.
What?
You own a player piano.
We do.
A beloved, it's
and all the rolls. All the scrolls.
This next part of the spark is dedicated
to
you.
How cute. Yeah. Oh my gosh. 16 player pianos.
16. So I've listened to as much of Ballet Mécanique as I could. It is, I think, maybe George would respond positively to this description. It is a bombastic sonic nightmare. It is one of those, like, it's like acid jazz for player piano. It is a lot.
Why?
And then
why
there's
16 of them?
Well, I don't, because that was his sparked vision.
Okay,
I don't know.
Okay, I'm not judging.
You can watch this on YouTube, and I've watched as much of it as I could. But there's a YouTube comment describing the accompanying video because it has a film that goes with it, a black and white film. They describe it, the video, as the tape from The Ring. Have you ever seen the movie The Ring?
Yes.
So you pass the curse of The Ring on that videotape and it's a nightmare.
No.
It's not that scary, but I thought that made me laugh.
That's so really funny.
While it's true that George didn't have any engineering training, he did know how to synchronize player pianos, which she had done for Ballet Mécanique. Listen, when we say sparks can come from anywhere,
what?
Sparks that change the course of a world war can come from anywhere.
Holy shit.
George's big spark was, if piano rolls can activate piano keys, why couldn't they activate radio frequencies in both the torpedo and the ship? So basically, and take this ride with me, Camion, because it was a little hard for me to understand, but you've got to play a piano and you know about the World War. Basically,
oh dear.
By using two miniature piano rolls that would start at the same moment and turn at the same speed, a ship and a torpedo could secretly communicate on the same pattern of frequencies. So if you have one roll in the torpedo and one roll in the ship and they start at the exact same time and it's changing what frequencies, it's hopping frequencies, they could communicate. They wanted their torpedoes and ships to communicate on 88 different frequencies, just like a piano has 88 different keys, creating an encryption system that no one could crack. They envisioned a fleet of these remote control torpedoes hunting down wolf packs of Nazi submarines, taking them down with deadly accuracy that had never been seen before. And they called it their secret communication system.
Wow.
I'm just like, so they basically took Hetty's idea for a, she was using, basing hers was based, was sparked by the Philco, a very early remote control system.
Yeah.
And his was, his piece of it was sparked by his knowledge of player piano rolls.
That's right.
And the two of them, her peanut butter, his chocolate, mixed together to create the secret communication system.
That's incredible.
I think it should be noted, side spark. There's one theory that Hetty stole the idea of frequency hopping. An engineer accused her of smuggling the idea away from those conversations at her husband's dinner table or even if from his boardroom. But according to Alexandra Dean's documentary Bombshell, which having mentioned is excellent, the record is clear that the Germans had not come across the idea. That I don't think that there's record of this. Alexandra Dean talk in an interview about how inventions, and we've talked about this in the past, how inventions it start to pop off on different places on the globe, and then somebody will like bring it together,
and then it's a race. It's a race to the finish. But she's saying that, to anyone's knowledge, the Germans weren't even onto this idea, and no one over there was working on
it. So how would she have smuggled it out of the boardroom the dining room when the Germans weren't working on it? In his book, George Antill described how Hetty was ready to quit MGM and go to Washington, D.C. to offer their services to the Inventors Council. Side spark. In World War One, Thomas Edison had come up with this idea that Americans could come up with the inventions and solutions to win the war. And this continued into World War II. There were posters everywhere saying, send your inventions to us at the Inventors Council. The Inventors Council agreed that the idea that they had come up with was brilliant, and they connected George and Hetty with a physicist at Caltech who was an electronics expert. Their invention was issued a full patent, and they donated their invention to the National Inventors Council. But it was generally understood at the time that if the military used an invention, the inventors would be paid. But they gave it, I guess the Inventors Council then turned it over to the Navy, and the Navy said, wait, you want to put a player piano in a torpedo? Get out of here. Shut him down. And George, who had bills to pay, he was like, I'm done. I'm out. But Hetty, maybe because she was eager for this to exercise this brain and for her brilliance to be recognized, wanted to keep developing it. So the patent was put into a file and labeled top secret, and the Navy told her that she would be helping out a lot more if she went out and sold war bonds instead of trying to invent something.
Couldn't she just be pretty and show up in a dress and get people to buy war bonds?
But guess what? That's exactly what she did. She would go to the Hollywood canteen. Mm-hmm. She would entertain the troops. She wasn't even an American citizen yet. And she was doing all of this work, and she sold $25 million worth of war bonds, which in modern currency is $343 million worth of war bonds.
Unbelievable.
And then after doing all that work, the U.S. government seized the patent in 1942 as the property of an enemy alien. So they used her to sell all these war bonds.
What?
And then they labeled her an alien.
Why? Why did they do that?
I don't know.
Just to get the patent out of her hands?
I don't know. And I don't think she knows. And I don't know that history knows. I don't know.
So I'm so curious, is the answer like in figuring out like, so what happens when they seize a patent? They now own it. Like they're basically saying, so you're an alien. You can't have an American inventor's patent.
It gets pretty murky in here. And there's some statute of limitations around it too. So after a certain point, it doesn't matter.
I mean, the irony also is like, she wasn't even asking for money. So like, you didn't need to do that. She wanted to work with you and wanted to give it to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so a drag.
Then.
Okay.
Back
then,
to Hetty.
And then.
This life.
This
what
is
a life.
Amazing.
To distract the troops, Louis B. Mayer put Hetty Lamarr in this third-rate movie where she had barely any clothes on. She's playing this character named Tonda Leo. It's totally like, you would never see something like this now. Her skin is painted dark. Like, but... which, you know,
is it's no wrong in now. So many ways.
But one of the ways it's wrong is there's this brilliant woman with this stunning intellect. And she knew by being in projects like this, she wasn't being respected for her acting like Garbo or Dietrich.
No.
And perhaps as a result, she was always in conflict with Louis B. Mayer. And she got the reputation for being difficult. She might have also been difficult, but I can imagine there may have been some, it may not be black and white, and there may have been some real motivation for being challenging.
Yeah.
She finally went out and produced her own movie, which was very unusual in 1946. She was very ahead of her time in terms of personal agency and feminism. During this time, she married again. She had two kids. That marriage ended. She was a single mother in her 40s. And at that time, her kids describe her as being a great mom.
Mm.
Then professionally, in her movie career, she played Delilah in Cecil B. DeMille's Samson and Delilah. It was a huge hit. The second highest grossing film of the decade, only Gone with the Wind surpassed it. So this is how big of a hit this was. And I think it's the thing that she's probably
most known for
in terms of her movie career. One of the things she's most well known for. You just smiled so big. What were you going to say?
I was going to say like, and yet like I have heard of that movie. I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
But I would say generally everyone knows Gone with the Wind.
Yes.
And they do not know Samson and Delilah.
Even though it was the second highest grossing film of the decade.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
So maybe didn't have the lasting power of Gone with the Wind.
Could be a lot of reasons behind that.
But she also, it gave her this idea. She decided to produce her own epic. Like she saw the success of that. She put millions of her own dollars into it. And then no one would distribute it. And she lost all her money.
Would they not distribute it because they were like, you can't be doing that? That's not how it's done.
Or if they were like, this film is not the best film. I'm not sure.
What was the name of that film? I want to know more.
I think it's called Three Queens. Should we have a viewing party?
Yes.
Yes. Turner Classic Movies.
You're all invited. Wait, so did it eventually get distributed? Like, can it be seen somewhere?
I don't know. Let's
find out. Good. Okay.
Here she is. Like, she swung for the fences. She's completely broke. She then marries another fellow, an oil man, moves to Texas. She's a trophy wife again, but she has got this big brain. She's this very creative person. She needs something to do. She didn't have much to do. She visited Aspen, and at the time, there was very little in Aspen. But she had grown up skiing and thought it would be a wonderful ski resort. So she convinced her husband to buy some land and she created Villa Lamarr. It was all Austrian and she basically recreated her homeland. As she built that, this marriage was falling apart and this time in her life is described as the darkest time in her life. Around the same time, her 11-year-old son almost died when he was hit by a car while he was riding his bike in California. She was called at the same time to testify in divorce proceedings from this oil tycoon husband. This is a spark. Here's a spark for you. She sent her Hollywood body double to testify at her divorce proceedings. The judge was furious and punished her by cutting down her divorce settlement. And as a result, she had a nervous breakdown. I'm not laughing because it's funny. I'm laughing because it's just like, it is so full of sparks. It is like, what? You wouldn't believe it if you read
it. And she did it like as a FU?
I don't think it was an FU. I think she was so in overwhelm that she couldn't. She was like, I need to be by my child's hospital bedside, not going to my divorce proceedings. Oh. But she's so smart, but that she thought that was going to work is a bag of bananas.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing. So she had two more husbands. Neither marriage lasted longer than a year, and her behavior, her children said her behavior was becoming more erratic and unstable, and this was most likely due to drugs provided to her by Max, Dr. Feelgood Jacobson, who is a well-known figure in Hollywood. Hedy Lamarr was a patient of his from the 50s until he lost his license in 1974. My math says 24 years. He told Hedy that he was injecting her with special vitamin elixirs, but that turns out was methamphetamines, which at the time was legal. So she's hooked on meth.
Oh my God.
It's turning her into a monster. She's abusive. This once loving mother is like abusive towards her children. She's just a human being who is becoming a dumpster fire.
My God.
She's arrested in a department store for shoplifting. Even though she had thousands and thousands of dollars on her, she took $80 in merchandise.
What?
I know.
And why? And so she had, I assume by this point, she wasn't making movies anymore. But she also wasn't married to the oil guy.
Right.
She's afloat.
She is adrift. She is a mess. She's a mess.
And at this point, she's 60. She's 50 or 60.
I'm bad at math, but you're sweet to think that
somewhere
I'm good
around
at
that.
Math.
Okay. I just wondered.
But she's aging. She's losing her beauty.
Of course, yes.
So she begins to have plastic surgery to shore up her looks. She started having plastic surgery in her 40s, and she thought she could invent her way out of aging. One of her plastic surgeons even said that she was a groundbreaker in that arena. She would tell the plastic surgeon where to cut, where to hide the scar, and a lot of these things had never been done before. But which three cheers for invention,
three cheers.
But it got out of hand and she became disfigured.
No.
She was one of those like Jocelyn Wildenstein, unrecognizable.
No.
Unrecognizable. You have to watch the documentary to see
okay.
it though.
Okay.
We will not be posting that on our Instagram. But she started to hide away, no longer going out in public because of this failed plastic surgery, and the money was running out. So in 1969, she wrote to a friend in the Navy asking if he could find out what happened to her patent. And apparently the reply has been lost, but what she probably learned is that her idea of frequency hopping had been put to use in military communications. By the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when President Kennedy had sent ships to blockade Cuba, the ships that were running the blockade were all equipped with frequency hopped radios. And when she found out the patent was being used, she thought, hey, I'm broke. I could be making some money off this. But for Hedy to be paid, they had to use her patent before it expired in 1959. And there is evidence that they did give it to a contractor in 1955. And that contractor was handed that patent and was tasked to create with something called a Sonoboy. The inventor of this inventor of the Sonoboy had a website where he pays tribute to Hedy and George and their invention. This technology was also eventually used in surveillance drones that flew over Vietnam. But according to U.S. patent law, when a patent expires, the inventor has 6 years to sue for payment. But Hedy didn't know that this technology had been used, so she never made the claim because she didn't know.
No.
Yes. Yes. Drink it in.
Oh, no.
And I can't believe that's the first person that's happened to.
No, certainly not.
How do you know certainly if not. Somebody's implementing your patent?
And prior to the internet, you were in the dark absolutely. About pretty much everything.
So in 1990, starting in Forbes magazine, the mainstream media began to report the story about what Hedy had invented with George back in 1942. And when her son told her, Hedy said, it's about time.
Oh.
Then people in the communications industry picked up the story because they realized frequency hopping was revolutionary and it had found its way into GPS.
Oh my gosh.
Wi-Fi technology, Bluetooth, and these billion-dollar military satellites.
Oh,
Cam,
my God.
Are you having a visceral reaction?
I am. I feel sad.
Why do you feel sad?
Just that I'm assuming that by the 90s, she was nearing the end of her life. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I guess it's good that they recognized it, but it's awfully frustrating that she didn't get credit for that. And the support that she could have used in the darkest moment,
yes,
you know, of her life.
Yes. And the support she could have used as a brilliant mind.
Yeah.
And if you just think, oh, if she had more support,
oh my gosh,
what
yeah.
could she have made with it?
Yeah.
So I don't know if this is cold comfort, but eventually the Navy, the Electronics Frontier Foundation, Milstar, and Lockheed Martin finally gave Hetty an award thanking her for coming up with her idea. She was alive, but because of her disfigurement from plastic surgery, she didn't want to be seen. So her adult son, Tony, accepted the award on her behalf, and he played a taped message from Hetty saying, "I am happy that this invention has been so successful. I appreciate your acknowledgement of your honoring me and that it has not been done in vain."
Mm.
Her son said, "She would love to be remembered as someone who contributed to the well-being of humankind."
Mm.
And you have to watch the documentary because there's this brilliant moment where her son is in front of this giant ballroom full of people accepting this award. And Hetty calls on the phone.
Oh,
it is amazing. You have to watch it just for that.
Amazing.
It's a fantastic moment.
Yeah.
I learned most all of this from the excellent documentary Bombshell by Alexandra Dean. Bombshell was Alexandra. Here's a spark for you.
Yeah.
This was Alexandra Dean's, I believe, debut as a film director. And she knocked it out of the park. We've talked about the maker that Hedy Lamarr was, but to really appreciate her story fully, you have to see this film because you can see how physically beautiful she was juxtaposed with her brain and what it accomplished. And you can really appreciate the dynamic of storytelling that, and the way Alexandra Dean depicts all of this is so wonderful. When asked why she made the film, Alexandra Dean said, "When we close our eyes and think of an inventor, we don't think typically of a woman. We don't typically think of anything but a very certain type of man. We even might think of his pocket protector and the look on his face. We have a very specific idea of the people who shape our world and made it the way it is today. And think of the power of those people. And yet it didn't seem right to me that no woman or no person who wasn't this particular white man had shaped our world. It just didn't seem right. So I was out there looking for somebody who didn't fit that mold and who had been a great inventor. And boom, there was the story of a woman who completely didn't look like an inventor who had completely changed the world."
Completely. Touched almost every one of our lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Unbelievable.
Alexandra Dean, who I cannot get enough of. She is so, like, do yourself a favor and just Google her and listen to interviews with her. She is a really fun, smart person to listen to. She went on to say, "Someone said to me, Hedy Lamarr was not only thinking outside of the box, she didn't even know that a box existed. That's how she inspires me. Why do we even care that a box exists? Why not just live outside of the box?" That is my spark. And the question on the table as always is, what do we make of it? Well, first of all, make yourself a fun movie night and just like pop some corn.
Let's start there.
And dial it up. I think it's right now. I think it's on Netflix. I think that's where I watched it. So free with your Netflix subscription. There are so many sparks in this. I can't even begin.
There's a million.
I just can't even with you.
I can't even with this spark.
Before I spark off a little bit, I just want to touch base with you because I feel like you're still rolling with the feelings.
I really am. I just, just thinking about that tension that she felt her whole life. And even though I hear what you're saying about the filmmaker, you know, the quote about the box, I can't help but wonder if there was a moment in her life where she felt like like it or not, she had been shoved back into a box.
Well, she said there was a time when she stopped talking about and telling people that they had conceived of this invention because she was like, people didn't want to hear it.
No.
They didn't want to hear it. No. And so she stopped talking about it and it just went silent until there's this journalist who I believe was writing for Barron's and in the time of the documentary ended up writing for Forbes, who 25 years earlier had heard about, I think, hashtag dad sparks from his father, who I believe worked at MIT, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm reaching deep into my butt to pull this story out. But he had heard that Hedy Lamarr may have been responsible for frequency hopping technology from his dad's colleague at work. So had an idea, hashtag dadspark, passed on this idea to his son, who was a journalist. And this journalist called Hedy Lamarr and interviewed her and had hours and hours of tapes that kind of went, he might have done a story for Barron's or Forbes and then kind of tucked it away. Alexandra Dean had gone to every journalist that Hedy Lamarr had spoken to on the record. She went to Hedy Lamarr's children. She went to everyone she could think of to see if there was the sound of Hedy's voice talking about these things, because Hedy had already passed when they were making the documentary. They reached out to everyone and no one responded with any tapes of Hedy speaking on the record about her invention. In her desperation, waking up in the middle of the night with her heart pounding, saying, we've got to have Hedy's voice in this documentary. Yes. Alexandra and her team went back and checked every email they had sent, and they had gotten one email address wrong.
Oh my gosh.
And it was this journalist. Oh, they emailed him again within an hour, certainly within a business day. He was on the phone and he said, I've been waiting for your call for 25 years because I have the tapes. And he had cassette tapes behind his garbage can at his office. And he produced these tapes. So you get to hear, this is another reason to watch this documentary. Mm-hmm. You get to hear Hedy's voice, which also makes you emotional.
It does. It just really does. I just think I think, you know, there is a fantasy of like beauty and brains and you must have it so easy. Like that's everything, right? Then
that's
you have
true.
It all. Right?
If only. I've thought that thought myself, if I was just beautiful, this life would be so much easier.
That's right.
Yeah.
And yet
it does open a certain kind of door.
Sure. It opens doors. And then they're like, but just these doors don't, like, you're not allowed to go. Like, can you go back to selling the war bonds instead of saving American lives with your little ideas? Could you please just sell some war bonds? And I just feel
what a loss.
What a loss.
Can I share this? I transcribed this, but it's not in my spark, but can I share something with you? Yeah. So this great interview I watched with Alexandra Dean, which I referenced at the beginning during my spark sources, she had this message, which she really wanted to convey to especially young women. You do need to be aware that as a woman, the trajectory of your life may not be linear. You may not just stack up awards and achievements as you grow in power and authority as you age, just because you're bright and contribute a lot to society. You might find that it's more of a roller coaster because traditionally for women, their beauty or their physical attractiveness has given them tremendous power. And when it fades, that power goes away. And what Hedy teaches us is navigating that push and pull of being beautiful and having brains and wanting to be recognized for them is difficult and full of pitfalls, and you have to have your wits about you and realize what's important. And at the end of the day, Hedy didn't realize what was important. She botched her face because she thought it was so important that her beauty remain intact. She did not realize how powerful her mind was or the contributions that she had made, but those contributions became what she was known for. That's why she's a legend today. That's how she's made her mark on the world. So if women are watching this or listening to this podcast to know a bit more about how they should live their own lives, I think the message is really put a lot of eggs in that basket of your own intellect and brilliance, and don't pay too much attention to people's reactions to your face. That changes and is really irrelevant. It might be fun for a while and have fun with it, but treat it for what it is, which is this passing existence in beauty for a while, and then you pass through it. Your mind, the things you do to help the world, the things you do out of your heart, these are the things you may really leave as a legacy. This is what will give you power in your life, real power, power you can rely on, power you can be proud of.
Fuck yeah.
Those are the words of Alexandra Dean.
No, that is absolutely the
truth. That's it, isn't it?
That is the truth. And I'm 100% with her. And I think that Hetty learned the opposite lesson, because when she was messing with her face, I think at that moment in her life, that all she had been taught was, your beauty is all that matters.
This is, you know,
because you're going to disregard the rest. And then eventually it came back around. But, you know, for in that moment in time, how could you blame her? Because the only thing that she was being valued for was that.
That's
at that
right.
time.
That's right. I've said this, and I don't mean this to be, I mean, I love myself, and I actually love my body, and I love my face. And that love has grown over time. It's grown over time. I didn't always feel that way.
Yeah.
But because I never traded on my beauty, I've never traded on my looks. I think I have an easier time in these later chapters of my life, because I'm just building on a foundation of trading on ideas and heart and my winning personality.
Yeah.
And I feel sometimes for people who their beauty has opened so many doors for them, because I do think it's harder as one ages.
100%.
I don't have that 100%. Problem so much.
I feel like I have to give my mom some credit for this as well, because my mom was very much like, that's not what we're going to emphasize.
Yeah.
Despite, you know, recognition that I may have gotten, or any of her kids may have gotten along the way, she'd be like, uh-huh, that's nice. We're not giving that power.
Yeah. And as you know, my mom was never like, put on lipstick before you leave the house.
Yeah.
Like, never the focus. Yeah. Never. So, you know, there's an upside to that.
And now look at us scrubs. Now we're just owning it. We're scrubs.
I have to say, though, when I see myself now, there are many times when I look at myself and I'm just like, what a beauty.
Oh,
what a beauty.
That's so awesome.
I think it has a lot more to do with figuring out my own taste and style, what I love. And also there's a glow from within.
And strength and knowing who you are.
Yeah.
100%.
What else do we make of it? Well, I'll say just the story of her escaping that house of her first husband, of drugging the maid, of cycling off into the night and escaping to London. That like 24 hours would be a thriller. Of a screenplay.
Like, I'm thinking like there's four different screenplays.
Oh my God.
You know, in there.
And
at least
the story of our first husband, Fritz Mandel.
That's
something.
That's right.
What do we make of it? Inventors, literally, not inventions, inventors. If you want to raise little inventors, delight in the intellect of the children in your life, whether that's your own progeny, whether that are they're your students, your nieces, your nephews. Delight in the intellect of children.
Yeah. Holy shit. That is the truth. And there's a lot of data in regard to girls in particular. Mm-hmm. And I actually, reflecting on my own life, like all the way through eighth grade, I was great in science. And even like in my yearbook was like best science student, eighth grade.
Oh, you don't say.
And then I'm like, what happened? Because I drifted off to other things.
Yeah.
And then years later, like 20 years later, I was reading about data. And I think that this data, I think we talked about smart girls, Amy Poehler's.
Yeah.
Right. I think this data is used like on her website as well. But when girls hit tween to teenage age, they are often tracked out of math and science. Mm-hmm. Like there's a million people with this data now. And I know there's great people that hopefully will feature on the Spark File, mm-hmm. Who are trying to do something about that.
Yeah.
But it still goes on to this day of like, oh, sweetie, your mind is meant for other things.
Yeah.
So if we can remember that, and the young girls in our lives, remember to encourage them to stick with that. If it interests them, stay with it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I love that. Support those who identify as women in science, technology, engineering, and math.
Yep.
Support them however you can.
Mm-hmm.
That's my spark, Cams.
Well, Suze, I've been a bright spot over here crying through the whole thing. One of my better episodes.
Thank you, Hedy Lamarr.
Honestly,
thank you, Alexandra
thank
Dean.
You.
And thanks to the people who produced that documentary,
yes.
including Susan Sarandon.
Oh, thanks.
Great work.
Thanks
y'all
for
check
sharing
it out.
That story. It's a biggie.
It's a
good
big spark.
One. Yeah.
Should we take a break?
I need one.
All right.
Thanks.
The spark
me, baby.
So,
Cams.
Suze, we're going to take it in another direction, mostly because I need to stop crying. Okay. I'm really moved by that. That was such a good spark.
I don't think, like,
so good.
I don't think I have seen you cry through a
like
spark.
Like a nice, slow, continual cry?
As much as you did during Hedy Lamarr.
Just
I wasn't
quiet
anticipating
tears.
It.
Just so you all know, so you can, you know, visualize, it was just quiet tears streaming down my face.
Through the whole thing, pretty much.
It's great.
Once it
great
started.
For radio.
Great. Muffled sobs.
So, yeah, mine's going to be much lighter, and I think I'll stop crying, which is really, really good.
Spark me, Amadeus.
Okay. So, I think I've mentioned this spark to you in conversation over the years, but I thought I might take a little deeper dive here on the Spark File. You know, I read an article a few years ago. It turns out it was 5 years ago now, and it really made an impact on me. It was in Harper's Bazaar, and it was about a woman who worked as a creative director in a New York City ad agency, okay. where her job consisted of making millions of creative decisions every day. But one thing that was stressing her out was choosing an outfit in the morning.
Oh.
And it just
I've
really
struck
excitement. Me. Right. Because
yeah.
we've talked about this
yeah.
a little bit, but like somehow this idea of like, what are you going to wear today had been imbued with the pressure of like each and every outfit needing to illustrate her competency as an executive, her creativity as a creative director, her leadership, her intelligence, her sense of humor, like all of it. And every day became like, is this what I should, like, should I wear this? And is this saying everything I needed to say? Just became a burden for her
yeah.
to just get dressed in the morning.
Can I sidespark for
yeah,
a minute?
Yeah, please.
I am fascinated by this as somebody throughout the course of my life who has, like, we were talking about this with Jill Twiss the other day, mm-hmm. who has struggled to define personal style. And
yeah.
finally, I feel like now,
yeah.
at the tender age of 50, it's kind of
you
coming
got it.
Into,
you got it.
I'm nailing it. But I think an episode of a TV show and then subsequently a film, and it was the same costume team. Design
interesting
team.
Yeah
and there's a woman on this design team and her name escapes me right now, but she every day
yeah.
that we all report to work, she would have this amazing fresh look. She would have this amazing fresh look that was like self-expressed and completely inventive and completely creative. And I remember asking her, I was like,
wow.
I was like, do you just go home after a long day's work and spend an hour curating what you're going to wear for the next day? Because it was, I mean, looks on looks on looks on looks. And she was like, no, I just like in the morning, it comes to me like fast and fresh and she throws it together. And I was like, I admire it.
Yeah.
And I think I may be more like in the camp of how about a uniform?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because we'll talk a little bit about that. Like, obviously, that's a choice. And if you find that the way you dress is a form of creative self-expression,
yes.
and you take enjoyment from it, please continue.
Yes.
Go about your business.
Yeah.
But if you find
respond
it to be
to
stressful,
the freedom of yeah. a wardrobe. Got it.
Yeah. But if you find that it is taking up valuable space in your mind that you'd like to be putting elsewhere
towards other
got a
creativity.
Spark for you.
Yeah.
So in this article, she wrote about beginning to think about the amount of mental space that she could free up if she didn't have the burden of this particular decision every day.
Yeah.
Not to mention the time spent on it. So she looked around at her male peers in the office and they didn't relate to this issue at all. Because they wore a
they
suit every
their
day.
Uniform.
They had
yep.
their uniform. They were like, often it's the same suit. They change the shirt underneath, or maybe they just change the tie underneath. They didn't worry that their outfit wasn't going to reflect their worthiness in the workplace.
Yeah.
And they had more time and they had more creative energy just to focus on doing the work. So she adapted this idea to fit her needs. She decided on a work uniform for herself of her own free will, one that suited her personality in fabrics that she loved, that she felt comfortable in. You know, she allowed for a spark of her personality to show through. Like for her, it ended up being like a comfortable but sleek, like well-fitting black pant, a white shirt, but it had, it was a very specific, it had detailing. And she bought like 15 of them, a black jacket when she needed a jacket. And she remembered how her mom used to love to put a little ribbon in her hair. And as a little nod to her mom, as a memory of her mom, she used like this black leather bow around her neck. It was really thin. It was just a thin little, she tied a bow around her neck. Simple, easy.
Chic.
Yeah. She felt relaxed every morning getting dressed. She felt empowered. She felt like she was running the show, not her wardrobe, which was important. And this article really stayed with me for a long time. First of all, a confession for anyone who's like, Kimian, you're so full of shit.
Nobody.
Why do you think
the audience is...
I'll tell you. Because I am a child of the 80s. Like, I admit that no matter how you slice it, the incredible pull of consumerism is in our bones. We were raised in that. It was a time of buying things and having things. And literally, greed is good was the mantra.
That's the Wall Street movie,
the Gordon Greco character, like, greed is good. And that was never said in our household, obviously. But it was a sentiment that sort of permeated the whole culture.
Consumerism equals happiness.
A literal sense of like, it's never enough. Once you get here, you're going to want more. And it took some time and some years to unravel that in my own mind. And then just when I thought like we might have moved past it culturally, 9/11 happened. And I was living in New York City at that time. And as you know, part of the message in the wake of that event was, please buy things. Go out to eat and shop and see shows. Please, please, please spend your money because our economy is counting on it.
Yeah, proactive messaging around that.
That's right. Yeah. And so this was also the era of Sex and the City, the clothes, the shoes, the outfits. Like, it was very much, and I was 100% like, I love that show. And I was totally in that era in New York City at that time.
That's right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think that it was very common to be like, you can't, that concept of you can never have too many shoes, like the Carrie Bradshaw,
like,
and this idea of
never,
like,
wear the same outfit twice.
Yes. Yeah. And like the person you were describing, well, I may have a day where I wake up and I feel more bohemian than I do today. And I want to have this just in case I'm feeling bohemian. This is my bohemian look, right? What if I'm going to a music festival? I'm going to need to have this to have that look. I'm going to need all the shit, frankly, that now when I reflect on, I'm like, I never needed all of that. But I definitely, you know, was guilty of it at that time. But by 2009 and the housing market crash, the recession, and those times were over for everyone.
Yeah.
And honestly, I felt like it was a relief in many ways of just like, I'm so ready to pare my shit down, simplify, minimalism started to become a thing, you know? So when I read this article, and the article was by Matilda Call, she's the creative director, it resonated like a fucking bell ringing inside of me. Like, it just truly, truly spoke to me. I knew that I wanted to change my approach to work clothes. I didn't want the stress of it. I didn't want to spend my creative energy on it. Like she said, I have so many creative challenges at work to keep my mind stimulated that I don't feel an urge to express myself creatively through what I wear. I finally had enough. That's what she said. And I didn't want to go like as extreme as she did.
Yeah.
But I did want to make my own life easier. Just easier. And for me, that looked like a wardrobe of like mix and match pieces. Understandably, like most of them are black. But that's for ease. Like that's not because I love black more than anything. I'm like, once you're in it, it's just easier to mix and match.
But it's also easy day to evening. You do a lot of day to evening stuff. Right. So it's easy to...
and then accent with like a splash of color from time to time. So it is super easy. And I find that I can get up and ready and out the door so much faster. And I have more creative energy in the morning.
Yeah.
So yeah, sometimes I think about like those stats, like how much time we spend like sleeping in a lifetime, which is like 25 years, or how much time sitting at a desk, 5 years. And I just wanted to cut down on the amount of time standing in front of my closet, wondering,
clothing
rack. What am I going to wear? Yeah. And is it clean? And what would go with that?
Yeah.
And when did I last wear that? Who cares? So it turns out there's a lot of people have taken this route. FYI, and I feel a little proud. Once I dug into it, I was like, oh, okay, I'm not crazy. Barack Obama once said,
oh,
I'm trying to pare down decisions. I don't want to make decisions about what I'm eating or wearing because I have too many other decisions to make.
Word.
And it's funny that he mentioned food because I feel like that's next for me. Like I really crave like a meal delivery service. It's just like, just tell me what I'm eating today.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Whereas
or
for
maybe
some
a personal
people,
chef.
Whereas for some people, like that is a major outlet for creative self-expression.
That is correct.
They love to cook. They love to. Our friend Benjamin Hagel, he during his workday sits and like when he has a little downtime, he's a very big job, but when he has a little downtime, he sort of like formulates what he's going to make for dinner. And for a long time, this can't possibly still be true, but for a long time, he didn't make the same recipe twice.
That's amazing.
Yes. So
that is amazing.
It was a major source of creative self-expression
yes.
for him.
And that should be continued. Like that's embraced and celebrated. And I hope any person who feels that way about it
goes
forward.
But for you, you're like, that's not my creative self-expression place.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that just knowing that we have permission to make the choice that suits us.
Yes.
You know, I think that in regard to the like work uniform, I think some people are kind of terrified of like, well, you can't do that. Well, people will think I'm wearing the same thing. On day three or four, when you say to them, I gave myself a work uniform, no one's going to think that anymore. You know, like you're not wearing the same pair of, literally the same pair of pants every day.
Yeah.
So choice. So obviously Barack Obama has much bigger questions to answer than what I'm going to, you know, than I'm working on, but it's all relative. And I think that it's okay to say, I want my creative energy for other things.
Yeah.
So while it was a woman who literally made headlines for giving herself a work uniform, she did like the number of places where this story ran, which I didn't know at the time.
It
I just saw it in one, but it caught fire.
The spark caught fire.
People did like follow-up stories. Five mm-hmm. years later, are you still wearing the same thing?
Spoiler, no. She's adjusted it. As
yeah.
She's gone from short sleeve to long sleeve. Like she's figured out. She's tweaked it.
Yep.
But so when a woman did it, the world sort of freaked out and wrote about it everywhere.
Okay.
But the smartest men in the business have been doing it for years and years and years. Steve Jobs.
Yes.
After a trip to Japan in the 80s, he came back inspired to develop his own personal uniform.
Issey Miyake was his designer.
That's right. The black turtleneck.
Yeah.
But Levi jeans and tennis shoes. I think they were Balance or New Balance. I'm not sure. Tennis shoes.
Yeah.
Albert Einstein, gray suit, no socks. Disheveled hair.
Gray suit, no socks. Well, he was ahead of his time.
There it is.
Yeah.
Andy Warhol, 501s, button-down shirt, blue jacket, striped tie.
Wow.
Alfred Hitchcock, dark blue suit. David Byrne said, people remember you better if you wear the same outfit. Interesting. Mark Zuckerberg, famous for the hoodies. But I did not know that he actually sent a memo around when he made the decision to have an official work uniform.
Just so he was like, just so you know.
Just so you know.
I'll always be wearing the same thing.
This is it.
It's clean.
Yeah, it's clean. It's my thing. Yeah. And I want to be focusing my energy on other things. The author Jackie Collins had her own take on the idea. She kept a closet full of black tank tops. She simply rotated the custom jacket that she wore over them.
Yeah.
So she had different colors and different fabrics. They all had the same silhouette and they were tailored. They had the sharp shoulders.
Yeah.
But that's how she made her life easy. She knew she was going to black tank top and then just what jacket.
This works for my body. This works for my lifestyle. This works for my creativity.
That's right.
And this is, I love this.
I'm just fascinated. It didn't occur to me to talk about it as a spark, but then I was like, I've been sparked by this for a long time. Yeah. And the freedom and the potential freedom that, so I thought I would share it.
I love it. I love it. And it's making me spark about just our own lives.
Yes. And I think there's other aspects to it that I think will spark you too. But one of the things that seems to be a worry for people is whether or not it's going to feel like their creativity is suppressed by the process, mm-hmm. you know? And when Ad Age interviewed Matilda, they asked her, don't you ever get bored of the monotony? And she said, that's what some might think, but it's in the nature of my line of work to be innovative and create things that have never been seen before. I guess that brings me more than enough variation and excitement to be happy to have at least one part of my life that runs on autopilot.
Yes.
Right? Just check that off the list. And I read this great article in Esquire, that was written by a man who tried this experiment. So super, super interesting. But in that article, they said 19th century psychologist William James said that what we do as part of our daily itinerary is crucial to our functionality. The more details of our daily life we can hand over to the effortless custody of the automatic, the more our higher powers of mind will be set free for their own proper work. Which is just interesting philosophy that's been around for a while. How much can you put on autopilot so that you can free up the deeper thinking in your own mind? So it also seems to me that this is like completely up for personal interpretation. Like there's no rules. No one, like if you say I'm going to have a work uniform, like no one.
And that in and of itself is a creative act.
Yeah. Yes. You can change it anytime. You're totally in charge of it.
Yeah.
So you can add a bit of surprise and whimsy to like show your personality if you're worried about like, well, then no one will know that I'm creative or no one will know this or whatever. All of that is still possible. But from day to day, you can eliminate the clutter of decision making that you need to do. Just brain space. So some of the benefits include saving time, like not just stressing about what am I going to wear or putting outfits together, but shopping.
Yeah.
So much less shopping.
Yeah.
Saving money. Matilda bought in bulk. So when she found the shirt that she wanted, she got the manager of the store and said, I'm going to buy 15 of these.
What can you do for me?
What can you do for me?
Oh.
Negotiating.
Ooh.
So you save money. You might save on self-doubt, like just eliminating throughout the day the like, oh, I shouldn't have worn this.
Yeah.
I should have done something else. And no, this is what you're doing. Yeah. End of story. Save yourself the stress of the visual noise of an overflowing closet, stuffing things into drawers. Save yourself the guilt about things that you haven't worn.
Yeah.
Save your creative energy. But now I also have to admit that the desire to save my mental energy has rolled into a bigger issue. You might also be able to add save the planet
to
this list.
Yes.
The fact is the fashion industry needs us to buy new clothes 4 to 6 times a year. Actually 6, because they've now added resort season and pre-seasons to the 4 seasons. Yeah. They already had us buying things. And they are the second most polluting industry there is, number 2 behind oil and gas.
Wow.
That's right. So I have no ill will for the fashion industry. Like I'm seduced as everyone else. Like it's gorgeous and fun. And frankly, works of art, like fashion is a beacon of creativity and inspiration. And I love all of that. But the buying of things that we don't need, when I still have clothes that fit, when I've chosen carefully, you know, and I have things that last. But it's their job to convince us that those things are out of style and we need new ones, you know, all of that. But Susan, recently I learned about this company, Kuyana. Have you ever heard of them?
I have not.
Sus, this lit me up. Their tagline is fewer, better. Fewer, better. And they make no bones about it. They are not trying to get you to buy more. They want you to buy less.
But higher quality.
But better pieces that will last longer. Quality over quantity.
This is my jam.
You will love them. I haven't even bought a single piece. I'm just in love with
the idea,
the concept. I want to support them. Any business that is like bold enough to come forward and say, we're not going to try to.
Is everything like $1 million?
It's though? Not. It's not. Yes, it's probably, it's a little bit, it's more than fast fashion.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. It's not more than what I spend on clothes now. It's very comparable, but you might spend like a cashmere sweater might be $200. But based on this concept, I was like, it's going to be $500. You know, it's going to be beyond. I think they are attainable prices. I'm not saying like that's nothing, but they're very clear. They will last for years. And as you know, and have known for a long time, I'm all about price per wear.
Price per wear.
So another article that I read years ago, and Susan can attest that we talked about it, I don't know, a decade or more.
Yeah.
When you look at price per wear for your clothing, rather than like, oh, this coat is $100.
Yes.
But this coat I'm going to wear to one fancy event, that price per wear is $100 per wear.
Yeah.
Here's this sweater for $100. I'm going to wear that sweater for
till
the wheels come off for the next 5 years.
Yes.
I'm going to wear that sweater 100 times. That's $1 per wear.
Yeah.
So when you look at like those investments, I know this is a very privileged conversation, so I don't mean to be flippant about the amount of money that it is.
No, I was thinking of that with Matilda. I was like, that even if you're buying in bulk and saving money price per wear, it's an investment. What you're talking about can represent a real investment.
That is correct. And I think you don't have to do it. Like I didn't do it all at once.
Right.
I just found that there
you found
were certain
what works
brands.
For you.
Yeah.
And then you return to those brands and return to those pieces that sort of fit within that wardrobe that you've established
that's
the foundation for.
Yeah. And when they're on sale, then I'm like, great, I'll get another pair of these pants that I love.
I love this.
So I don't know. I feel like it does suit the world we're living in now to think about like, yes, creative energy, that is precious. And that alone to me is decision enough. Like it's enough to inform that decision. But also we've spoken about wanting to consume less
and create more. Yeah.
And so this is one way to consider doing that.
I have so many sparks popping. May I?
Yes, please.
I do think about my 2019 consume less, create more challenge that I set for myself, which was, I feel like I've mentioned this, bear with me while I mention it again.
Yeah.
I decided I had a theory, a hypothesis that I was replacing actual creation with a counterfeit substitute of buying stuff, like looking at pretty pictures online, putting things in a cart, eventually pulling the trigger on it. And I could justify it by saying, well, those pieces will then be self-expression when I put them together in different looks, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But I was like, let's just like do a little research on this. And I was like, if I purchase less clothing, specifically clothing, shoes, that sort of thing in 2019, I have a hypothesis that I will make more because I won't be using time, money, resources dedicated to that shopping. But I also will want the good feeling that comes from, sometimes it's a dopamine hit that comes from buying, and a deeper good feeling that comes from actually creating. And I have to say, at the end of the year, here's the tally. I bought one souvenir sweatshirt from the Performing Arts Project.
Nice.
I bought one vintage, I'd never seen anything like it before or since, Pendleton jacket.
Lovely.
On sale, 50% off.
Yes.
And I bought on final sale at the end of the year, right before the end of 2019, so it didn't feel great, I bought four sweaters that are part of what I think of as my uniform.
That's right.
For when we teach/podcast in public.
That is right.
Because I have learned a thing or two about what uniform works for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got to do a lot of different things.
That's right.
In addition to being like, I want it cuddly, I want it to keep smells in to protect the people near me.
A smelly teddy bear.
It also has to, it has to be comfortable. It cannot itch. I want it to look pleasing. So I want it to be, yep, to be, to fit well. And here's a super bonus. I have to be able to fit two dogs inside it so that when I'm editing or writing at my computer, it's big enough, yep, that I can fit dogs inside of it. None of this is a joke. All of,
yes,
this is real.
It's awesome.
And it has that with a pair, like I'd layer shirts underneath it, and then a pair of what I call my creativity pants, which are, this came out of this year,
yep,
this year of living, yes, less consumerly, which was I take pants that I already have. Eventually I'll run out, but right now I have it. And I paint them with colors that are pleasing to me.
Yes.
I smear them, I spatter them, I paint them, and I love them.
Yes.
They make me so goddamn happy.
Yes.
I can't even tell you when I wear them.
Yes.
So that's my uniform. And so I did sneak that in right under the wire because I was like, these prices are unbeatable.
I mean, yeah.
So, but that's not bad. A total of six items. And as I say, when we talk about goal setting, even if you if you set a goal and say you don't exactly meet it to the letter, you still ran the ball so much further down the field than you would have if you hadn't,
yeah,
set the goal. I felt that way about my year of consume less, create more.
Yes.
I bought six things as opposed to the hundreds of dollars worth of things I would have bought if I hadn't,
yes,
set the goal. And I created a metric shit ton.
That is correct.
Yes.
And that illustrates the point exactly.
It's a confluence of all these things, though, like also defining that uniform,
that's right,
has been a real liberator for me.
That's right. And you defined it by like, what functionality does it need,
yeah,
to have? What does it need to say about me? How do I need to feel when I'm wearing it?
That
and
is,
you were thoughtful
that is like
about
so
all of
much
that
of it. In addition to keeping the smells in and keeping the dogs in, like I also, I feel good when
that's
I'm in,
right,
it. I feel comfortable and strong and creative.
That's right.
Yes.
That's what this entire Spark is all about.
I
and
love it.
We,
I love it.
Yay. We talked about that clothing thing before the year started. And I too was like, okay, I'm going to consume less. And I tallied, I bought 12 items, which on average is one per month.
That's pretty
good. And that's so much better for,
yeah,
me. That's great. And I also...
Were you crazy selective about those items?
Yeah. I mean, like, I would put some... There were times, like, especially on Instagram, they'll be like, that's cute. Punch, you know, a hit,
it to
tap
the cart.
It,
yeah,
add it to the cart, and then be like, ah, actually, I don't need that. And I don't need to spend any more time on this website. Go away.
Yes.
And I was just more conscious of that, of like, I don't need any of this stuff. So I feel now, and it's very empowering to say, like, I have everything that I need. I do. So to join the items in my wardrobe, you have to be something that, like, you might be a duplicate of something that I've learned I really love and I want to snatch you up while you're on sale, or I don't want to miss having that because I know you're a piece that I'll wear,
yeah,
a lot. Or you have to, like, pass through this test that I now have of, like, you know, is this going to enhance my life in some significant way? And if not, then A, you don't get my money, and B, you don't get my time.
I love it.
So I think that what you just described, though, is what we make of this Spark, or what I hope people will make of it. Just a thoughtful consciousness about their consuming, about self-expression, about permission to make it easy on yourself, and whatever that means. If that means less of things, if that means scrapping all of it and starting from scratch, whatever that means to you, you have permission to make it fucking easy on yourself.
I'm also, it's so funny. I'm laughing here because I'm thinking about our listeners. Like, I feel like we shout you out every time. Hi, Andy Berkey. I think about you because I think if you were a guy, not to make this gender,
yeah,
but if,
yeah,
you're a guy and you are like working in your shop and you're like, who gives a fuck? But I feel like even Andy thinks about and makes t-shirts that express something about him.
That's right.
That I bet when you wear that shirt, Andy Berkey.
And I want one.
Andy and Berkey. We both like one. My sizes are. I feel like.
Must fit two dogs inside.
That's right. Must contain two dogs. I feel like it isn't just for people who maybe have dressed. I don't know. I don't even know what I'm saying, but I feel like this is a spark that isn't. It's not just for you and for me. I feel like it has further reach.
I think so too. Like if you know that the physical activity that you do, like in several of these stories, I read about a woman who was an art director.
Yes.
Who, I mean, like in an art gallery, who would be lifting paintings, putting them up and stretching and moving. And over the years, she found the fabrics and the brands that worked for her. And she's like, and for the last 20 years,
function
I've been wearing the same
form.
Thing.
Yes.
Yeah. And you can like give yourself that freedom of, freaking donate all that stuff. Like I know that Marie Kondo and cleaning out our clutter is a whole other spark.
Yeah.
But you have permission, like get rid of all that stuff.
That doesn't work for you. Those shoes that don't work for you, they don't feel good on your feet. Like
get rid of them. Boop, and boop, if you have that favorite shirt that you're like, I don't know why, I just love when I go into the garage and I'm wearing this shirt and I'm like, this just works for me. Like if you're able to get 10 of them and forget all the rest.
Or get what you need. Like that's another thing. I love in our closet. Yes. Like Nathan has, I love Nathan's clothes. He really buys those great pieces that are built to last and they do express him as a person and they fill up a little tiny slice of the closet and then the rest is my fucking bag of tricks. But like, but I do feel like by the time I die, whether that is tonight when I'm hit by a bus or 50 years from now, hey, we never know. Maybe I'll have like winnowed it down and distilled it to just like those perfect pieces.
Well, to me, like that's also a fantasy of like less visual noise.
Yeah.
As I get older, like I really like
I am so
a pear
sparked
aesthetic.
By this.
Yeah. And so I have a fantasy one day, as you can see from my closet right now, this is not the day, but one day, you know, having just one of those closets that feels relaxing to walk into
space
because
between
I love
the hangers.
Oh my gosh. That's
space
a luxury. I've not
between the hangers.
Space between the hangers.
That's our new spinoff podcast.
What's the name
space
of the spark,
between the
actually?
Hangers.
I'll be naming that spark space between the hangers.
There's something about space between the hangers. I am so crazy sparked by this. Yeah. And it sparks another spark for another day that I've been badgering you with for some months now, which is there's a book called The Curated Closet.
Yes.
About how to
do that.
How to distill down your taste and style to those pieces, those essential pieces that they all work for you. They all work together.
Yep.
And I've been for at least a year been begging Camian to take that journey with me, but maybe I'll force it on
you
with a spark.
We will. Yes.
And,
yes.
And I'll make you do it whether you like it or not.
Totally. We're going to do it.
I love it.
And then I'll just mention one other thing. Like there's 1,000 resources and blogs out there, like the blog and the guy who writes like before 5 a.m. And it's all about those people who like the morning routine is the essential productivity tool, basically, right?
I don't know that everybody's wired that way, but sure.
Exactly. Yeah. Not everyone is wired that way. But in that Esquire article I read, one of the benefits the guy got from it was by reducing that time, he created a morning routine with that extra time that was beneficial for him.
Yes.
That was, you know, a healthy breakfast and 15-minute workout. You know, it was significant to him.
Buy back some creative time.
Take it back.
I am so sparked by this.
You own the morning. Spark. So one takeaway, you have a choice, do it or not do it. And if you are doing it, however you're doing it right. Go forth and have fun.
I can't wait to look at my closet through this lens. I love this cameo.
Awesome.
I'm so sparked by you and by this podcast and by all of it.
Yes.
I think that's it.
That's it.
Ah, we hope this put another bunch of sparks in your file. Listen, if there's a spark you'd like us to explore, or if you've taken a spark and fanned it into a creative flame and you'd like to share that, will you email us at thesparkfile@gmail.com or submit it through our website, thesparkfile.com?
We'll even take your feedback, but you know the price of admission. First, you need to share a creative risk that you have taken recently.
And be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe, rate, 5-star review it. If you like this podcast, would you please, it would mean so much to us that you would share it with people that you
love.
It really does make a big difference. And if you didn't like it, that's okay. Nothing is for everybody.
If something tickles your fancy and gets your creative juices flowing, we're writing you a forever permission slip to make that thing that's been knocking at your door. It's your turn to take a spark and fan it into a flame.
You got to ballet bar it. You got to surgery scar it. You got to patent frequency hopping and Hedy Lamarr it.
You got to take it.
And the tears come again.
And make it.
Oh, Hedy.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my spark files. Could be something that I want to make or how I want to be. I pump it in my spark files. I jump into my spark files. Let's open up the spark files. Did
you ever wonder what it would be like to be part of the SparkFile coaching community? Here's how the SparkFile community describes it.
The most honest, safe, life-affirming, and life-changing experience I've had in all my 55 years. The best.
I'm incredibly grateful to Laura and Susan for teaching me the tools and structures that I need to get past the fear and to just do it anyway.
The SparkFile is a portal to your creative powers and believing in yourself.
This group is spiritually, emotionally, mentally
supportive, creative,
amazing, encouraging,
life-shifting, and liberating.
Uber talented, warm, thoughtful, lovely, wonderful people.
I need a group like this to give me the kick in the ass that I need to start making the things that I want to make and do.
This big, beautiful, creative trampoline that just like catches you gently and just launches you out with so much love.
If you want to learn more about the SparkFile Creativity Coaching, including our 6-month Blaze course, visit thesparkfile.com/blaze and schedule a no pressure, no obligation call to find out what is possible and how we can support you. It's time to take it and make it.